Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen and I'm talking to Jane Smiley about her novel 10 Days in the Hills. It's great to have Jane here. I can't say that she's flown from America just to see us, but we have nabbed her. And it's always great to have, doesn't happen that often, to have at the book club one of those glamorous creatures, an American novelist, because I don't know how aware you are of this, Jane, but discussions about British or English contemporary fiction often kind of devolve into some discussion of why American novelists can do this or that, and we can't. So Jane will tell us, I hope, later on. And I'm going to ask her questions just for about 20 minutes or so, and then you can have a go. Jack, her partner who's here, told me just now that you can ask Jane any question. She's got an opinion about absolutely everything. That's guaranteed.
You can ask him, too.
And I guess that I hope, Jane, you won't mind me saying this, for a sort of academic critic, your fiction is particularly sort of juicy because Jane, every sort of novel does some kind of completely new generic thing you couldn't have predicted from the previous novel. So she's done historical fiction, but, you know, a bit of American history, but she's done 14th century Greenland as well. And she's done a fantastic campus novel, and she's done contemporary fiction of sort of love and loss. And she's done, amongst other things, something that I don't know if you would must tell me in a second if you think it's the right word, that I call, because that's what they called it a few hundred years ago, imitation, which is when you take a book that's already there, a book that actually lots of people know really well and love, and you sort of follow its contours, but reconfiguring it and adapting it and changing it. And 10 Days in the Hills follows less closely, but still is sort of overtly kind of shaped by or written in as a homage to, I don't know if you think that's the right way of putting it, Boccaccio's, the Decameron means 10 days, roughly speaking, Boccaccio's title. And Jane's novel has at the front of it a quote from the Decameron to give you the clue if you didn't already pick it up from the title.
Can we read all the epigraphs? Because
yes, okay.
I would like to start the discussion by reading the three epigraphs because they'll put us in the mood.
All right.
And the first one is from the last book of In Search of Lost Time. I thought that I had arrived like the caliph in the Arabian Nights in the nick of time to rescue a man who was being beaten. And in fact, it was a different tale from the Arabian Nights which I saw enacted before me. The one in which a woman who has been turned into a dog willingly submits to being beaten in order to recover her former shape. And that's where, when Marcel, or M, I mean, is walking around during a blackout and he happens upon a brothel and he peeks in the window in that voyeuristic way. And this is what he sees. And I thought, well, if that isn't about the movies, I don't know what is, you know. And then the next one, because I had this Russian section in here, I just happened to be reading the new translation of the short novels of Anton Chekhov. And in the introduction, Pevier writes, Gogol once boasted of dead souls. All Russia will appear in it, but later confessed that he had made it all up. And so that shows he's a true novelist. And then the one from the Boccaccio is, but a little after nones, they all went and refreshed their faces in cool water before assembling at the queen's request on the lawn near the fountain, where having seated themselves in the customary manner, they began to await their turn to tell a story on the topic the queen had proposed.
So it's a kind of, the Decameron is quite a sort of, some people might think it's quite an unlikely kind of model for a novel because it's mostly just people sitting around talking and telling each other stories.
I knew that a modern reader wanted a novel rather than a story cycle. Story cycle was a common, like the Canterbury Tales, it was a common form in Boccaccio's time. And in fact, he had a lot of sources that he used for his stories. But he updated them and made them apparently apply to his own time. And I loved that idea, but I knew there had to be a kind of overarching structure or novelistic type movement, and so I decided that I would adjust it in some ways, but still have the 10 days and still have the 10 characters and still have the sex and still have the...
But the sex is kind of, in the Boccaccio, the sex is quite often, there's quite often sex in the stories, but the characters are quite so decorous,
right,
aren't they? Yeah.
Right.
And there are seven women and three men, and they kind of, if they express any sort of sexual feeling, it's only in the stories they tell, isn't it?
They're always kind of reticent about that, but then they tell some quite erotic but also entertaining and joke-like sexual stories. It's not just one thing. One of the things that happened was that after I read the Decameron, as I said in my little piece in The Guardian, I went on to read the Heptameron, which is a French book that in some ways is the first or kind of the ur-novel of France, even though nobody probably now living in France, or very few people are aware of it. And the reason it had such a long life was because clearly Madame de Lafayette, when she wrote The Princess of Clèves, she was aware of the Heptameron and the question posed in the Heptameron, which is, can a woman be virtuous and know true love? And all of the, and this is a riddle that Marguerite in the Heptameron poses to her nine friends, and then their stories are supposed to illustrate this. And of the 72 stories they come up with, they can't come up with a single example where a woman can be virtuous and know true love. So it's much more gloomy than Boccaccio. But apparently, it seems to me that Madame de Lafayette was clearly familiar with the Heptameron, and she decided to go about solving that riddle in The Princess of Clèves, which was published in 1665, I believe, or around there. And The Princess of Clèves was quite a famous book, and people pondered it and thought about it into the 19th century. So this question that Marguerite asked as her response to the Decameron in many ways shaped the French novel and therefore the European novel for centuries to come. And so I thought that it was really wonderful for me to discover the Heptameron and to realize that this was a sort of perennial, you know, quest to tell these stories. And also Marguerite said, you know, they have to be true stories. They can't be stories that you got from a book. They have to be stories about your friends and relatives. And so the Heptameron allegedly is about real people that are being gossiped about.
And you took some of the actual stories in the Decameron and put them. I didn't spot every one. I spotted.
Well, there are six.
Six. No, I didn't spot every one. I tell you how I could usually spot them. I thought I could usually spot them because the characters in the stories told in Boccaccio seem a lot kind of craftier than the characters, than the American characters in your novel. So whenever there's a kind of story involving lots of disguise and subterfuge, I think kind of, oh, that maybe that's one of the ones from Boccaccio.
Cause, well, you spotted the Henry Miller one, right?
Yeah, yes, I think I did spot that one, yes.
And
what about the man who only manages... I guess that the man who only manages to persuade the Russian woman to sleep with him by saying that he's Archangel Gabriel.
Yes, that's one.
That's one.
The story that...
well, with Boccaccio's stories, if you think, oh, that's a bit like Chaucer, then that's kind of... Because he nicked half of them. Yeah. Well, not half of them.
No, Chaucer came second.
Yes, no, Chaucer stole some of them from Boccaccio.
But another one is when the characters go to the Russian house and they asked about the story of the tapestries. That's a Boccaccio story.
Yes.
That I rewrote a little bit.
Because in the Boccaccio, you get sort of, I mean, not all the stories are stories of kind of faithlessness and adultery and subterfuge, but some of them are. So you get in the Decameron things like the whole of the seventh day, 10 stories, because there's usually a theme on each day, and one of the characters decides the theme, and then each of the other characters has to tell a story on this theme. And on the seventh day, I think it is, they all have to tell stories about the tricks wives play on their husbands.
Yeah.
And they're really good stories. And they're all about these kind of very jealous men who are idiots, of course, you know, and who are very jealous and are convinced their wives are cheating on them, and the wives are cheating on them. But the very sort of jealousy of the man makes him vulnerable to being tricked. And but your sort of Californian characters are much more sort of they're much less deceitful. And
why would they deceive? There are no rules.
Yes. Well, I know that's exactly what I was going to ask you about. I mean, they're sort of, it seems that sort of
well, they have deceived in the past.
Yes.
And they've over the years gotten, you know,
so for, I mean, for,
out of the need to deceive. But what I think I substituted for the deception between among the characters is the self-deception of themselves and the stories that they tell about themselves. The characters in this book accumulated around the figures of Max and Elena. Max is the director, who's maybe past it a little bit, and Elena is his girlfriend, who writes self-help books, how to do everything correctly. She's got a little bit of a obsessive compulsive personality disorder, and so she loves to write books about whether you should, you know, change the oil yourself and then take it to recycling, or whether you should be, you know, how to do this sort of thing. And so once I had those two, then various other characters sort of came around. Well, obviously they had children, and then so then there were spouses, so then there were boyfriends, so they all get together more or less by chance, and then they find themselves in a family reunion that they didn't ever expect to be in. So that part was fun for me.
It's kind of funny that sort of bit where you say there's no rules, because I was thinking that I almost felt sorry for the character sometimes about that, because although some of them have been married to each other, none of them are actually, and there's a, as we'll come on to in a second, there's a good deal of sex in the novel, and there are couples in the novel, but nobody is in a sort of married couple. So the Boccaccio plot, which always depends on people sort of being cheating on spouses, isn't possible. And it's almost like, as you say, there's no room for deception. There's a moment when one of the female partner of one of the male characters said, "Oh, by the way, I slept with that young man who's the son of that friend of my ex-husband's."
And person.
Yeah, and all he can say is that an appropriate thing to have done? You know, that's the kind of most.
Well, that's true, but also he's her therapist, so is it appropriate for them to be sleeping together?
Yes.
But on the other hand, he's not certified by any board. He's a self-made.
It's quite a strange
therapist.
Kind of therapy he offers.
Not
to
in California. Actually, his name is Paul, and he's one of my favorite characters. And I did use. Did you catch that his ancestor tale is from Boccaccio?
No, I didn't. I missed that.
When he talks about one of his ancestors who had been the most sinful man in, and this is the first story of the first book of Boccaccio, the world's greatest sinner, and so I decided, well, I was going to take that and see what I could do with that. And Paul is a man who comes from a family where there's ministers in every generation, so he says they've got religion in their DNA, and so he's interested in religion all the time.
He's your favorite.
He's one of my favorites.
As I was reading, I was wondering, although it's probably not for the author necessarily to have a view on this, I was wondering how much I was allowed to dislike him.
You can dislike yes. any of them. I really like him, though, and he's always right. So that was the juxtaposition for me, was making a character who was disliked by the characters around him, and yet he never gave bad advice. He just wasn't appealing. There's one line in the book that I laughed myself when I wrote it, and it was he says something. He's sitting in his yoga posture, and he says something, and Stoney and one of the other characters catch each other's eye, and he knows that the other character is thinking, if he's so enlightened, why isn't he rich? Which is a really Hollywood thought. And that's a thought I laughed out loud when I wrote that line.
I think it's because he gives quite good sort of advice and opinions, but when you're with him, as it were, in his mm-hmm. thoughts, he sort of thinks a lot of sort of baloney, which he's too wise to actually say to any mm-hmm. of the other characters. So it's sort of the opposite of what you expect when sort of people might talk pretentious mm-hmm. nonsense, but think quite straightforward things. Mm-hmm. And he says quite straightforward things, and then thinks this yogic sort of stuff about the energy flow that's
going...
Seems
like bullshit to you.
And what about the way...
Let me just say one thing.
Yeah, go on.
We live in California. We're surrounded by people with aspirations to enlightenment. And I was very skeptical about this when I came from Iowa. And I was introduced to a woman who was an energy healer, and the person who introduced me to her said that she was so powerful that she had lifted him off the table until he fell on the floor. I thought, oh, yeah, right. So my index of any kind of response is always to horses. And so I invited the energy healer to come and be with the horses. I thought, well, they'll get her number, you know. So she came. And one of the horses had suffered some problems in his foot, and she was going to do some energy healing with the thing. And so the horse came over, she did this for about, no more than a minute. And pretty soon the horse was looking at his leg and looking at his foot. And so then she went on to some of the other horses, and she did some stuff with one of the mares, and then she took off her sweater and hung it on a post, and pretty soon the mare was over at the post sniffing that sweater to see exactly what was up. And finally, when she was finished, she was a sort of bejeweled person, and she had metal buttons. And the horse, who was kind of the dominant horse of the group, he put his lips on every one of her buttons and her necklace, all the metal things. And then when she turned around to put something down, he grabbed the back of her thong that was showing above her jeans. And I said, you know, I don't know what's going on here, but there's something going on here. They are responding to her in a way I've never seen them respond, you know, by curiosity and just, you know, fascination. It was clearly equine fascination. So whatever was going on, and whether she healed them or whatever, there is something going on between them and her.
Saying Paul, if he'd met a pony, he would have...
You betcha. That pony would have been on him.
As you say, you say, he sort of exasperates the other characters. He's in the one sort of real outburst of something, a kind of which shouldn't be done, shouldn't be said. He actually gets hit at
yes.
one stage because he's mm-hmm. got this kind of exasperating to some of the other characters tendency of what do the Stoics call it, apatheia, isn't it? He's a you know
yeah.
it's all just an illusion, and it's all
right.
And you can sort of rise above it by realizing that, and
he's non-responsive in a way.
Yes, and so he's your favorite character, but I mean the other characters are kind of arguing about the thing which in the Decameron, the characters flee Florence because of the plague, the Black Death mm-hmm. in the 14th century. So they're in this idyllic sort of villa while somewhere else this terrible disease is raging. And in your novel, the kind of the equivalent of that, which is sort of there but not there, mm-hmm. is the Iraq War, which has, you know, just started, or they're five mm-hmm. days in at the beginning of the novel. And he gets hit because, I mean, he's above even that, isn't he? Isn't that right?
The person who hits him cites Bishop Berkeley.
Yes, yes.
For no reason, you know, because somebody said that to him once. You know, he says something is illusory. And they get mad at him and say, well, it's, you know, he says, but I didn't say flee. I know what they say. They say, oh, you enlightened people always say that bad things are illusory and that they'll soon be over. And he says, I didn't say fleeting, and I didn't say, I just said everything is illusory, even the good things. And, you know, there are substantial and respected belief systems that do say that the material world is illusory, and he believes that.
Yeah, Dr. Johnson kicked a stone and said,
"That's right.
I refute him thus." Yeah, and Simon whacks him on the face.
That's
and he
right.
Falls off his bar stool, but nobody gets very, very upset about that.
I think at that exact moment they're awfully surprised that he would have done that, and Elena would be upset, but she's kind of surprised. And then Simon gets out of the way.
So, does your liking for him as a character imply that you have a kind of that?
I have a semi-Buddhist look. Of course, it does.
Yes, does it? It does. And a semi-Buddhist attitude to all the political unease and dispute that you put into the novel by some of your characters. I mean, there's one of the characters, Elena, she's pretty obsessed with it, isn't she?
Yes, she is. There is a dialectic going there. I would say that until Bush got elected, I was progressing nicely toward a Buddhist attitude. and then I could get no farther, you know. Once the cheating and the lying and the bombing began, I decided to take a little hiatus from the Buddhist attitude.
Yes.
And
so Elena is your sort of hiatus from the Buddhist attitude a bit.
She's got my opinions, but she doesn't have my personality.
No.
I'm not neat. You know, I would never write a book about how to do things correctly. But so she's got that part of it, but that I don't have. But she's deeply, 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 deeply offended by the crimes and misdemeanors of certain someone.
And she, her relationship with Max, with which, I mean, you start with the two of them, and you say Max is a bit past it.
As a director.
Yeah, but he's also kind of
guy, yeah.
It's also this kind of, there's this thing, well, I should ask you about directing. He's at the beginning of the novel, although not on day nine. On day one, he's impotent, isn't he?
He is.
Yes.
That's a geopolitical problem.
Yes. So there's a relationship. There's a relationship between...
He's a liberal.
Between Elena's political...
How could he be potent and go to war at the same time? You can't do that if you're a liberal.
Is that so? So his sexual problems are related to his partner's political passions, are they?
Well, that's what she fears.
Yes.
But I actually think it's not related. I think it's just a kind of random thing. And that's what he thinks, too, I think. And so, you know, partly it's my joke, wanting to make the central sexual relationship in the novel revolve around impotence.
Yes.
And... But I do want to entertain her view that it's the shock of... I don't know what it was like here. And maybe you all felt the same shock in mid-March of 2003. But where we were, the shock was so deep. It was like the shock of being forced to commit a murder when you didn't want to, you know, and of having no recourse. And for... Maybe some people liked it, but most of the people I knew were just sort of stunned by the whole thing. And in such a state of kind of disorientation that it would be possible to be impotent as a result of that.
But you put in a character, Charlie, who is That must have been a tricky one to do, because he's the one who I felt a bit sorry for him, really, because he's got nine against him. Now, that was bad, was it, from Phil? So, but he's the one who
That's what I did to him. But
he's the one who sort of has Republican sympathies and thinks that actually probably it's a good idea.
But what good have they been for him? That's the, you know, when he arrives and he's got his, you know, his corporate ideas and all this stuff, and he realizes in the court, or it is realized about him in the course of the novel, that, you know, it hadn't done him a lick of good.
But then I sort of suspected that, having kind of whacked him about a bit, that you then maybe didn't exactly feel sorry for him, but you had a sneaking desire to give him a kind of a bit of a bonus solace, because he gets a bit of completely unanticipated, gratuitous sexual gratification with a woman 40 years younger than him.
He does, but I don't know that you'd call it gratification.
Is he not?
She's a communist.
But isn't that the frisson for him? I thought that was.
I don't know that he gained pleasure from that. I think he tried to.
Well, your description made it sound as though he did.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, no, but it was a low sort of pleasure.
I thought he was pretty humiliated by her, because every time he kept thinking, every time he thought he knew what should happen or what was about to happen, she pulled the rug out from under him once again. And finally, he just closed his eyes and closed the lights out and hoped that she was no longer there. That was a scene that John Updike...
Oh, he loved that. John Updike really, really liked that. He thought that was absolutely the sort of beating heart of the novel, didn't he? I mean, that's a good... It's a good... I don't know. John Updike wrote a very complimentary review in The New Yorker, wasn't it?
Yeah.
About the novel. And said... A hilarious thing for John Updike to say. He said, this novel reaches, I can't remember exactly his phrase, a new benchmark in sexual explicitness. You know,
for a non-pornographic novel.
Yeah, but I mean, he said it with a slight tremor of shock.
Well, he says everything with a twinkle in his eye.
Yeah.
Okay. I would like some of that. Yeah. Thank you.
And, I mean, I'm sure it was with a twinkle in his eye. But
I have to tell you that the last time I saw him, I was at the American Academy for a thing, and he was sitting here, and I sat down right next to him, and he had just done a eulogy and come to sit down, and he didn't realize I was sitting next to him, and we were sitting just like this, and when all the things were over and people started to get up, I put my arm around him, and I said, Mr. Updike, do you recognize me? And he looked at me and he said, oh, you're Jane Smiley. And I said, yes, you've made me famous.
Well, you're the first book club interviewee who sought physical contact with me. And I tell you, it's been two long, lonely years of doing this. So even if it was in the guise of John Updike, I know, it makes a double compliment, really. I mean, I should ask you about the sex, especially because I said facetiously at the beginning, but it was true that one of those things, one of the several things that when people have earnest discussions on the TV about fiction, it's one of the things on the list that Americans, they'll do it without seeming ridiculous. Which is to have sex in novels, you know,
English writers don't.
They have sex, but it's generally regarded as always being absolutely, you know, either at best inadvertently farcical, and at worst kind of dismally self-revealing, you know.
So
and
sorry.
And you know that there's this thing, the Bad Sex Award, which is awarded.
No, I didn't know that.
Well, you're obviously an ingenue. but there's a thing called the Bad Sex Award, which is given every year, and the winner has to pretend to Gertrude Tudor, really pleased. It's awarded to, you know, laughable attempts in English, or I think in British fiction, maybe Irish as well, I don't know, but in British fiction, to represent sort of sexual pleasure. And and it's like a sort of warning label, I always think, to... certainly to kind of literary novelists who want to be taken seriously and not mocked. I think people who write perhaps genre fiction don't worry about it. So don't try and do this, because you'll just get a bad sex award. And it's generally thought, but American novelists, you see yourself or, you know, I don't know, Philip Roth has lots of sex and, and nobody gives him a bad sex award.
John Updike has lots of sex.
And there is, there's a lot of very exact anatomical.
I was raked over the coals by Erica Jong for being too uppity and thinking that my writing about sex was not going to encounter some kind of backlash the way hers did. So, you know, there might be some undercurrent in America, but I don't think it's either expected or unexpected. You just, if the spirit moves you, you do, and if it doesn't, you don't.
Although,
do you think in French literature you're required to write about sex?
I'm not sure I have there. Yeah, I mean, I would have thought, yes, in fiction it's quite an important ingredient. But I would say there's certain things about the way you do it which are peculiarly un-French as well as un-English. So, for instance...
The funny parts.
Quite a lot of it's quite funny, in a way.
But isn't it always? I mean, isn't quite a lot of it funny when you're doing it?
That's rhetorical or...
answer when the time comes.
Well, you know? I don't know. Some might think so. I mean, you know, I don't think the French would think so. I mean, I think the French would take that line. It was one of the characters in Laurence Sterne's Tristram Shandy says, "Sir, there is no inclination more destructive of lust than laughter." But you obviously don't think
that. No, I don't think that.
But also one of the things which is maybe not so French is that lots of they're mostly middle-aged people or people in their 50s having, I mean, most of the closely described sexual.
But I wasn't talking about lust here. But from the beginning, what I wanted to do was talk about love, which meant to me that sex was incorporated into their love for one another. And whether their love was, let's say, lasting, like Elena and Max, or not lasting, like Paul and Zoe, or incipient and habitual, like Isabel and Stoney, I didn't see that their love could be expressed without plenty of sex. And also things kind of depending on the sex. I mean, I think... The story that came to me latest and continued to intrigue me since I didn't know what was going to happen was the story of Stoney and Isabel. Now, because it was inspired by Boccaccio, here was a 37-year-old man who had been sleeping with a girl 16 years younger than he was, a not done thing in the United States of America, since she was 16 and he was about 30, I think. And so once I knew I was going to incorporate that, I wondered what was going to happen to them. And so I think what happens to them, in my view, is that they realize, yes, they have been sleeping together for a long time in a sort of idle way, but what's happened is that they've now shaped each other's responses, both physical and non-physical, and they're ready for something deeper than what they've had. And so I really enjoyed sort of following that, having the sex come first and having the kiss come last for them. You know, so that was a fun thing an enjoyable thing that the scheme of the novel sort of presented to me that wasn't part of the original.
Well, it's time. I've got some other things about the ending, but I'll leave those.
Oh, okay.
I'll leave those. I want to off. But I'm hogging it. So please, if anybody here would like to ask, as Jack says, any question at all, I think you can ask about sport or anything, whatever.
You can, actually.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just wondering about Cassie and Delphine, especially... going back to Boccaccio, and I think John talks about this in one of his Guardian reviews. He says that you don't really give them as much voice as the other characters. You don't see it through their perspective as much. And then you talk, and Cassie says about how, you know, when you reach, is it 65 or 70, you kind of have to justify your cause and why you're still here, and in order to carry on. Yeah.
Thank goodness.
But I just kind of made that link there, that you don't give them as much voice as the other characters, and wonder if you can elaborate on that anymore.
Well, they actually get to talk a lot. They just don't. I just don't go inside them. As I do with the others. And it was partly because I wanted to retain a sort of air of mystery about them. Cassie's based on a friend of mine who really was the person whose mother wrote Since You Went Away, which was a movie, and who really was the person who was portrayed by Shirley Temple in the movie that was made of this novel. And every time, I love this woman, and every time I say, you know, I saw so-and-so on TV, or I ran into so-and-so, or blah, blah, she'll tell me a story about how she knew that person. You know, the gossip that her mother brought home about Joan Crawford in 1942. So I knew, and there's always that Hollywood person, that inside dopester. So I wanted her to express herself only through being the inside dopester and the gossip.
I grew up in the Midwest, and I... When I started reading the book, I'm like, there's a lot of graphic sex in here. And not, you know, graphic, like pornographic sex, but I'm wondering what your thought process was like when you were writing this book as a Midwesterner.
Well, you know, what I thought was that I wanted the sex in the book to have the same sort of tone as everything else. I didn't want there to be a build-up to sex, and then, you know, the reader, you know, wipes her brow and picks the book up again and goes on, you know. What I really wanted from the reader was for her to read through that sex scene and keep reading because she wanted to know what the next thing to happen would be. And so I wanted the suspense to trump the sex. And I thought the way to do that was to locate all the sexuality inside the individuality of each of the characters, so that what kind of sex they did, how they felt about it, was a clue to their character and personality rather than an interesting thing in and of itself. And what that did was it sort of freed me to make it funny, to make it not very good, to make it weird, to make it occasionally good, you know, to make it revealing or not revealing. And so that was the key for me, to keep my interest in order to keep writing. But I knew that it was going to taper off, and it does. It does taper off as at the end. For example, at the beginning of the last book, we don't see graphically what Stoney and the two Russian girls do, because who cares anymore? We're much more interested, or at least I at that point was much more interested in what they talked about afterwards.
Well, I think it's time to release Jane to her guardian Chardonnay or whatever you want. And will you sign books afterwards?
Absolutely, sure.
And just to say thank you very much.
Can I use this pen, though?
You can, as long as I can have my copy back.
The Uniball is the best pen.
And just to say thank you very much to her for coming and entertaining.